This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. I am Noel Debien, sitting in for Andrew West. And the eco-friendly Pope Francis's controversial Amazon Synod does begin this week. 30 million people live in and around the rainforest itself, most of them Catholics. The Pope has called the Amazon the Earth's lungs, but currently rainforest fires there are being widely reported. But it's not just deforestation and illegal mining that is on the Synod agenda in Rome, where it's being held. And Dr. Massimo Fagioli, who happens to be the Professor of Historical Theology and Religious Studies at Villanova University in the US, is following the Amazon Synod closely.
There are some who say that the Pope shouldn't talk about science or environment. So this is the new frontier that has to do with the health and the survival of the future generations.
The countries involved, Brazil, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, Guyana, Suriname, French Guiana, which is actually an overseas territory of France, these cover different language groups and very different peoples, don't they? How do you make any sense out of this many different countries?
It's true. The Catholic Church is actually the largest non-governmental organization that has a global voice on this. What made the preparation of the Synod different from the previous ones is that there has been a very thorough and wide phase of consultation of these local communities.
Why would this Pope be particularly interested in a gathering of bishops and others from the Amazon?
The Synod on the Amazon is a big test. We will see how far the Church is willing to go. Francis, since the very beginning of his pontificate, has started from the assumption that reality is more important than ideas. What's new now, this synod could break the taboo that everything in the Catholic Church has to be done exactly the same way, no matter the specific local cultures.
This synodality idea is about local church gatherings. I know it's a technical word, but it means when they meet together. I think there's 184 bishops coming together for this one. There will be 80 non-voting lay experts, including 33 women. So there's, you know, about 200-odd people who will meet in this synod. When they do that, you say they could come up with things that look strange. Is that what you're saying to people outside the Amazon who don't understand the Amazon?
What is happening so far in these communities, every few months there is a bishop or a priest that shows up to give the Eucharist and to administer the sacraments. So this document is very clear in saying we need to transition from the pastoral ministry of visitation once in a while to a pastoral ministry of presence.
In other words, what you're saying is there's 30 million people in the Amazon forest itself and in the countries surrounding there's more. You're saying that they don't get mass more than once every few months. That's for a visiting priest or bishop. And they're proposing a new model where they get the sacraments given to them by somebody being present. But if they've got too few priests, how do they do that?
Well, the document of the preparation says very clearly that we need to think about ordaining married men to the priesthood. The assumption is local communities have a right to have access to the sacraments. That is a paradigm shift that I cannot emphasize enough how important that is. It would be the first time that in the Catholic Church of the Roman Rite of the Western Hemisphere, there is the ordination to the priesthood of married men who do not belong to the Eastern Catholic Churches.
In Australia, we have the Maronites here. There's quite a lot of them. We have the Ukrainian Catholics, both Catholic churches that have had married clergy forever. And we now have Anglicans who have come over as well in the new ordinariate. But what you're saying here is that presumably they find the catechist who is already working here, already leading the community, who happens to be a married man, and they say, let's ordain you a priest. Is this the sort of plan that's coming out of these regions? Is that what they're suggesting?
Well, it's one of the plans. It's the one that is stated explicitly. It's not the only point. So there are other points, one of them being we should reconsider the ministry of women in different ways. the document doesn't go further, but clearly the discussion has been already about the ordination of women to the diaconate. It's no longer the ideal of squeezing into these local realities an ideal of the priesthood that is a Roman, European, medieval ideal. That could be really the beginning of changes in other parts of the world.
Massimo Faggioli, you're putting your finger on another issue here, though, because part of the document of preparation, the Instrumentum Laboris, talks about a different idea of vocation. In Rome, in Australia, in America, the idea has been that a vocation develops inside the person, and you say, I believe I'm being called to the priesthood, whereas what's being advanced here is an idea of the church saying, Jose, you're our catechist, we need a priest, will you be ordained? The community calls people to ordination. Am I recalling that correctly from my reading?
I think you're reading that correctly, also because that has happened already in the history of the monastic communities. In the Middle Ages, they were called to be monks, not to be priests, but some needed to be priests. And so the communities was choosing some among them to be priests.
We're talking calmly about this, but I'm also aware that Cardinal Raymond Burke, has said he's having a 40-day crusade of prayer and fasting. German Cardinals Walter Brandmüller and Gerhard Müller have objected to this. There is a group of lay people this week who've launched an appeal to the angels against the evil spirits of the Amazon Synod. They talk about confusion. What is this opposition about?
The opposition is the same opposition against Pope Francis that we saw at the Synod of 2014-15 on the family and of 2018 on the youth. So it's the same sociology, let's say. There is a rejection of the idea that the Catholic Church needs to make some changes that respond to local communities. So what they see in Francis is like the spectrum of everything that they think shouldn't happen.
But you're saying more than that, aren't you?
Yeah, because what is more and more apparent in the opposition against Francis is the rejection of the project to de-Europeanize and de-Occidentalize Catholicism. And we have to decide if we want to care for these communities of real people, or if we want to stick to a certain ideal culture, ideological also culture of Catholicism. That's the big choice. And Pope Francis has made clear what his choice is.
But in the end, for example, in this country next year, we will have what's called a plenary council. And the Australian Church will come together to evaluate itself and to vote on decisions about its future. Now, this synod, the Amazon Synod, which of course meets in Rome, by the way, not the Amazon, there's 184 bishops and priests. They're joined by 80 non-voting lay experts, including 33 women. Who actually gets to vote and how many women?
The membership of the Synod in Rome is still episcopal membership, which means bishops, with some exceptions.
It's all men, of course.
That's true. What's new, though, compared to previous synods of John Paul and of Benedict, is that there is a significant participation of non-bishops, of non-priests, and of women.
Massimo Faggioli, Professor of Theology from Villanova University, just outside Philadelphia. Thank you for being part of the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Journalist Lucy Morris Maher was the first to break the story that Cardinal George Pell was being investigated by the police. In her new book, Fallen, the inside story of the secret trial and conviction of Cardinal George Pell, she tells her own eyewitness account of the trials. Unlike many commentators, she was inside the room for each of the trials, and it's a unique perspective. Lucy Morris Maher, it's been a long time in preparation. Why write this book?
There was so much secrecy around this case. So this is a real definitive account of what happened behind closed doors when Pell faced trial.
I want to take you maybe to page 235 first. This is in the first trial, the mistrial. You write, as the court stood for the judge to leave, the buzzer rang, the jury filed back in, faces pallid and drained. The forewoman shook her head and simply said, no, we wouldn't, Your Honour. He'd asked if they'd benefit from more time. Silent tears rolled down her cheeks, you write. And later on you say, as Justice Kidd spoke, two women jurors began crying. It was a sorrowful sight. A man in his early 60s also wiped his eyes. What was happening?
There was an impasse, a hung jury. That means there's conflict and there's debate. And that's extremely draining. You know, for 3.5 days in a room with 11 other strangers, even the judge was very shocked. The whole courtroom was shocked to see how much they'd put into it. So it was actually really, really quite a sad scene, really.
But you also write on the next page, later it would be wrongly speculated among Pell's supporters in the media that the jurors had voted 10-2 in favour of finding Pell not guilty. Can you just clarify that? Because that's a rumour that has gone round in overseas press particularly.
Those numbers were never given out. No other legal counsel or anyone has access to the jury. They go to their room and they're taken out a different door. So unfortunately, it was just a rumour that seemed to become fact. I had journalists asking me if I thought it was true, and it's just not.
I recall in the appeal Justice Weinberg making the point that nobody knew those numbers. Now, I'm guessing that's talking about the first trial, which was a mistrial. The second trial, if I was to ask you what sticks in your mind most? Is it the verdict, I'm guessing?
Yes, when we had that guilty verdict, it wasn't what we were expecting, just because, of course, we'd had the hung jury. The media were not allowed in to hear the testimony of the surviving choir boy. To hear that guilty verdict after a total of 10 weeks of two trials, it was an incredible moment, really, to see this cardinal at that point. He was still the treasurer of the Vatican in the dock being told he was guilty.
You just mentioned then that you didn't hear the testimony of the choir boy.
No, we didn't. In the closing speeches with Mark Gibson, QC, the Crown Prosecutor, especially that first mistrial, he actually read out a lot of the quotes to the jury, you know, making his arguments. And it was quite a moment where I actually sort of stopped me in my tracks, because those quotes were very compelling. And I thought, gosh, if I'm hearing that secondhand, how did the jury feel hearing that firsthand? That was a big turning point for me.
I got the same sense from the Victorian Appeal Court judgment I've got. To say, for the first time reading through it in detail, which anybody can do online, by the way, I got a sense that I was hearing the voice of the survivor for the first time, that I could get some sense of who he was and what he was saying.
Yes, I agree. I read that as well. And there was actually even more detail in those documents. And I think if people read it for themselves, they'll make up their own minds.
You're listening to the Religion and Ethics Report here on Radio National on News Radio. I'm Noel Debien. We're speaking with Lucy Morris-Marr, investigative journalist and the author of Fallen, the inside story of the secret trial and conviction of Cardinal George Pell. Lucy Morris-Marr, in terms of breaking the story of this, can you give us a timeline of how this happened?
Yes, when I first set off investigating Pell and this whole clergy abuse, my subject matter around this was, what did he see or ignore or cover up in his younger days in Ballarat and in the Archdiocese of Melbourne? The Herald Sun, where I was, they weren't particularly across it. They weren't really aware the Ballarat hearings were happening. And I said, well, can I go and cover them? I've heard about this. But then through that groundwork, I then came across this story in 2016 that he was under a secret police investigation for abusing children at the cathedral and a Paul and Ballarat.
You write about this in the book. Forced out of the Herald Sun and put through absolute hell, and I quote, after Andrew Bolt attacked your story, revealing that the police were investigating Cardinal George Pell. Just tell us how that transpired.
I broke the story on the 19th of February 2016 in the evening. I knew exactly that it was like setting off a nuclear bomb. This was going to be a massive story. I knew it would be the front page. Pell was making statements from Rome calling for a police investigation, a public inquiry. And then suddenly it felt like I was smacked over the head sideways by my actual colleague, by my actual company. Andrew Bolt has a famous column every Monday. And he used that column on the Monday morning to slam the story, saying it's a witch hunt, speculating on my sources. And also he was hinting that he had some kind of acquaintance with the cardinal, saying it's not the behaviour of the moral man I know. Now, at the time, I felt no other option but to question News Corp and to question this situation. And so I did turn around and question News Corp, and it didn't go down very well, and it ruffled feathers. They didn't renew my contract a couple of months later, and it was absolutely devastating.
You also write that your other colleague, Gerald Henderson, who's the executive director of the Sydney Institute, but also a News Corp colleague, wrote damningly about your story as well.
It was all everywhere, and it was like being in this huge storm. It was like being in this bizarre Da Vinci Code in the middle of Melbourne, where I've got the Cardinal in Rome making threats, trying to deflect attention from the allegations against him into my story and how I got it. And then, of course, having these powerful right-wing figures in my own company then attacking me.
Well, in one sense, it sounds like you navigated through this just fine, but I want to go into it a little bit more, because Victoria Police later referred the so-called leak to Victoria's Anti-Corruption Commission in an attempt to find your source as well. So this was bigger than Ben-Hur, basically, wasn't it?
It was. It was absolutely getting caught up in something very dark and sinister. And it's not surprising that I was feeling very shocked by the behaviour of News Corp and my colleagues. They're the ones who actually commissioned the story. They commissioned me to do it. They created this whole situation I was in and totally misusing their powerful platform to basically be apologists for an alleged paedophile. And I'm very proud to have stand up to them, to be honest with you. I wasn't prepared to sit back and say nothing. And why should I not?
Why was there so much opposition to a journalist telling the story?
These people have had associations. They know the Cardinal for many years. They might not claim to be close friends, but they've known him. It's a lot of how network works. And I don't know if it's just that, but I think it did become a political and cultural war around this, and it's still going on. What happened to me back in 2016, these same figures, these same personalities, even though he was found guilty by a jury, etc., they won't accept it. They're still calling the poor surviving choir boy a liar. They're still smearing journalists like me, Andrew Bolt, even earlier this year did a ridiculous smear story in the Herald Sun.
I hear you got through it, but page 108, you wrote, "I no longer knew who to trust at News Corp. I was mentally and physically exhausted. A sleeping tablet hadn't helped. An ambulance called."
Absolutely. I mean, this is the effect it had. I had to take time off work, and I went back and I said, actually, I love journalism. I actually ended up apologising for complaining against Andrew Bolt, etc., because really, I love my job. And I thought, look, he's still working for the paper. It was a fast-moving situation. I'm not going to have my career suffer. I made my point. They said they looked into it. And so that was that. And I hoped to move forward. And I would have thought they would be delighted to, but they weren't. So, you know, no regrets. But at the time, it's a very dark time.
Lucy Morris-Marr, I'm interested to ask you about Justice Weinberg's dissenting judgment. And of course, Justice Weinberg referenced the Lindy Chamberlain trial and conviction in regard to this. What was your take on the Weinberg dissenting judgment?
Well, look, it's, you know, he's well respected, you know, through his career. He's been in Oxford. He's won prizes wherever he's gone, academically and professionally. But at the same time, he said things like he felt the choir boy testimony sounded concocted and not believable. Now, you know, out of 15 people, if you think the 12 jurors and the two other judges, they felt the opposite. This application to leave to appeal is with the High Court. And so they'll be deciding, is there even anything to see here? Is this worth going forward or is it not? They're not really going to be looking at what Weinberg said in Pell's favour. They now have to look at, obviously, what did Chris Maxwell and Anne Ferguson, the majority deciding judges, what errors of law did they possibly make that could get Pell free now?
Lucy Morris-Marr, investigative journalist, author of Fallen, thank you for joining the Religion and Ethics Report.
My pleasure, thank you.
Mahatma Gandhi made non-violence known throughout the world. He pioneered religious tolerance internationally. And this week marks the 150th anniversary of his birth. Well, Pramit Paul Chaudhry is the foreign editor of the Hindustan Times. He spoke to us from Delhi, and I asked him if Gandhi's legacy is still taken seriously in India.
Well, in India, obviously, he's just strongly connected with the independence movement. He's still called the father of the country by everybody, and every Indian school child is raised on that view. And so in India, I think both his standing and his reputation continue to be relatively solid. Overseas, I think it's primarily been his message of nonviolence and the use of, if you say, militant but nonviolent tactics to achieve political ends remains extremely popular and appeals, I think, especially to democracies, to middle-class societies, as being a type of political tactic they would obviously prefer compared to what they see in both the non-democracies and in revolutionary or insurgent violent areas elsewhere.
Satyagraha, the truth force that Gandhi taught, it was meant to change the mind of the wrongdoer, not to force. How effective do you think he was in persuading Indians of Satyagraha?
Well, Satyagraha itself derives from a very long Indian tradition of nonviolence, ahimsa, which goes back, if you wish, all the way back to the rise of Buddhism, Jainism, and a whole set of religions that, and social movements that arose 800 or 900 years ago. So he was very clear that he was deriving that school from a deep cultural recognition of that in India. Most Hindus, at least, are practicing vegetarians as a consequence. We had ended things like animal sacrifice, which used to be common in ancient India, was eradicated part of that movement. So he drew from that, and that remains, I think, very strong. It's not that India doesn't have violence. That's obviously the case. But it's should we say, morally and culturally accepted that you can use such a tactic to gain political or social demands. And that is why very common demonstrations, protests in India are very common, and almost none of them end in violence.
I know in some sense he's the object of intense debate, an argument among Indians. And I wonder if some sense his legacy itself could be colonized, adapted and changed outside India to suit cultural and political climates outside. I wonder in something like Hong Kong as we watch it, Satyagraha there, perhaps, is that what's happening? Is that what we're seeing?
Yes, I mean, I would argue, yes. The demonstrators there that you're seeing clearly are trying to avoid using weapons. They don't, as far as I know, not killed any policemen. The using Satyagraha is adopted in many cases by protesters who face an overwhelming state power. That is clearly pointless trying to use violence against that state power because you have no capacity to match the state. That's the first part of it. The second is that you're also trying to appeal, if you wish, to popular opinion at home and abroad. And the way to do that is to always maintain the nonviolence. And that's, I think, one of the things that you can see in the Hong Kong demonstrators. And definitely some of them have raised the fact that they see Gandhi as a model for what they do. And it's important to realize that it's not as if there have not been nonviolent political leaders in the past. But the point is that he was successful. And that's one of the reasons I think he appeals to more demonstrators and protests of that variety than normal. Because he was actually able to achieve Indian independence against what was at that point considered the most powerful imperial government of the time. So it's, as you saw in the Hong Kong protests you've mentioned, in the South Korean democracy protests a few decades ago. But the man who was really his greatest international follower was Martin Luther King, a man who visited India. Famously said, "I go to other countries as a tourist. Only to India do I come as a pilgrim." He was probably the most important and the most active disciple, if you wish, of Gandhi's of his activities.
Part of his early life, a lawyer working in South Africa, I wonder how much effect he had in South Africa on somebody like Nelson Mandela.
Mandela, in his own biography and in his own writings and his speeches, has made it very clear. He says, "I looked at Gandhi and the nonviolence that he preached. I admired it. But after a while, I concluded that it was completely impractical against the apartheid regime in South Africa, that you did not have a regime that would respond with anything except brutality." And so if you see Mandela's own autobiography, he mentions Gandhi twice and basically says, "Interesting idea, but I rejected it." That ultimately the freedom struggle in South Africa required a certain degree of violence to act as a pressure point on the regime. So his views on Gandhi, or should we say admiring, but he did not see them as practical as far as his own struggle in South Africa was concerned.
I'd like to ask you about India itself, though. He also taught, as part of what he was doing, religious pluralism. Yet from outside, we see Hindutva, we see the rise of a more militant form of Hinduism, and we see strife reported. How effective has he been in persuading Indians towards religious pluralism?
Well, it's built into the constitution partly because of Gandhi, partly because of Nehru. The two groups have always been, a number of political ideologies in India that were critical of Gandhi and Nehru, partly because of Gandhi's strong affiliation to the Congress Party. So both the left and the right in India strongly opposed Gandhi and his concepts of nonviolence. Now, what is interesting for Hindutva, as you've mentioned, is a new wave of, I would argue, really a sort of nationalism that is coming out of a new middle class that is coming out of India's economic wealth. Where does Gandhi fit into this is a big question. And what I would argue what we're seeing is that while the Hindu nationalist right wing remains unwilling to consider Gandhi as somebody of person of reverence, as they're growing politically, they're finding that actually they're probably better off appropriating Gandhi.
In a sense, he's a deeply religious figure, which in the 21st century might sound a bit strange. He advocated a simple life of poverty, spinning. And I wonder how well that example that he gave goes with an acquisitive, materialistic and rapidly growing industrializing India.
Well, his economic views, even during his own lifetime, were treated as basically slightly strange and eccentric, even by Nehru. When Nehru came to power as the first prime minister of India, he adopted a policy of heavy industrialization modeled after the Soviet Union, a five-year plan, all of which is in complete violation of anything Gandhi stood for. I mean, Gandhi's fundamental belief was industrialization itself was a form of violence, if you wish, that it was a violence against nature. And he posited a sort of village-based handicraft thing, which was probably impractical, but definitely was not accepted by the rest of the Congress party. And even when in the last year of his life, he himself complained or said that, accepted that he had been completely marginalized when it came to the economic thinking of the country. And that continues to be the case. What is interesting now, I would argue, is his adoption of a number of his positions. Ahimsa was one of them, nonviolence. The other was the concept of what he called non-possession. In other words, that people should live, as you mentioned, simply, but also they should keep in mind the concept of future generations. And this bled into another concept of which he had, which is what he called trusteeship, which is that ultimately all of the possessions that you have in the material world in terms of what you in nature, whether it's the oceans, the seas, the rivers, the forests, and so on, were not actually owned by you or owned by human beings, but they were essentially a trusteeship that they had with Mother Nature. So all these three ideas now, especially the last two in particular, are now being adopted as actually fitting in very nicely with the environmentalist movement. And we're seeing a lot of green activists re-energize Gandhi as a green figure. And curiously enough, that fits in very nicely with the present government of India. Narendra Modi is deeply concerned about the environment. Climate change is one of his biggest concerns. And in fact, it is very strong within the Hindu right as a whole. In India, strangely enough, the right-wing Hindu right is the party of climate concern, not the left liberal groups.
Pramit Pal Chowdhury, the foreign editor of the Hindustan Times, ending today's Religion and Ethics Report. And you can hear a longer version of that interview on our website. And also subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to abc.net.au/religion and subscribe at the bottom of the page. And some good news. You can now listen to us on your TV. You can find us on Channel 26 on your free-to-air digital TV. Thank you to Modita Dias and Emrys Cronin. I'm Noel Debien. Andrew West will be back in the chair next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.